There's no other way. On the plain below us, the Scaldi of the Marsi built up their fires, singing and holding games, drinking and shouting and dashing at each other in mock combat. For all of that, they kept scouts posted, watching the horizons. There were probably men of Gunter's steading among them, I thought. Men I'd known, men I'd served mead. We could hear them occasionally, the clear thin air carrying their shouts. If word of what we'd done to Selig's thanes had reached them, they'd kill us without blinking. We couldn't go through them, and we couldn't go around them. He was right. There was no other way. I pulled my wolfskin cloak tight around me and shivered. Then let's go, and may Eloah have mercy on us. I will not tell every step of that treacherous journey. It is enough to say that we survived it. Jocelyn rode back the way we'd come, flogging his poor mount, and returned in the lowering orange light of sunset to report that he'd found a trail, a mere goat track winding up among the crags beyond where the eye could follow. Turning our backs on the Scaldi, we rode back to make camp in the foothills, daring only the smallest of fires. Jocelyn fed it all night with twigs, and I dare say it would have fit within his cupped hands. It kept the warmth of life in our flesh, though barely. In the morning we began to ascend. After a certain point it was no longer possible to ride, and we needs must dismount and climb, using frigid hands and feet to find holds, leading the horses scrambling after. I lost my mount on the first day. It was a horrible thing, and I do not like to think on it. He sheered away from a crag when it loosed a small avalanche of snow and lost his footing. If I'd been mounted, I'd have gone over the precipice too. As it was, we lost half our stores, and I was sick at the poor creature's demise.
"Never mind,"
Jocelyn said through frozen lips, his eyes looking as sick as I felt.
"We've enough for two more days, and if we don't live that long, it won't matter."
So we kept on, shifting the bulk of our packs to the pony. I was glad I'd kept him with me, for he was surer-footed in the mountains than the tall horses. Jocelyn's mount we lost on a misstep. It happened after we had reached the summit, where the air was so thin we could not seem to fill our lungs, but gasped in breath like knives. It is beautiful in the mountains, so they say, and I dare say it is true. If I fail to describe the beauty of the Carmelines, do not think it is for lack of poetry in my soul. I fought for my life with every step, and could not spare the strength needed to lift my head and take in the view. We reached the top and headed down. It is easier to go down than up. It is also more dangerous. A pocket of snow, a hidden crevice. Jocelyn's horse snapped a foreleg. It was the second he'd had to put down, and no easier than the first. This time he held the cook pot to the vein when he cut it.
"One of Barkier Lanvers' men told me the Arcadians make blood tea when they're caught out in the desert," he said without looking at me. "They can live for days, and the horses, too. He's dead anyway, Fedra."
I did not argue. It was true. We drank blood tea. We survived the mountains and descended into Cumlach, the province of the traitor Duke Isidore d'Eglamour and the allies of Cumlach. It was too much to ask that we should pass unnoticed through the Dangeline borderlands. When they sing of this winter, the poets, none of whom stood atop the Carmelines, you may be sure, call it the bitterest winter. The Scaldi had been raiding all winter, braving the passes. The border was well patrolled. The allies of Cumlach found us that night. We were careless, it is true, relieved to be alive. Our campsite was secluded, and our fire small, but it might as well have been a beacon in those lands, which are little kinder than the Scaldi territories themselves, so close to the mountains. It was a small scouting party that found us, riding out of the darkness with a faint jingle of bit and harness, the firelight gleaming on male shirts. Jocelyn sprang to his feet with a curse, kicking snow at the fire, but too late. They were on us. They expected us no more than we did them, less, I dare say. No more than a score of men, mounted Dangeline warriors all, staring in perplexity at the sight of us.
My heart bounded and sank all at once, and I looked frantically for their standard-bearer. There, the burning sword emblazoned on sable, allies of Cumlach. Not Deglamore's men, though. Elowa favored us. Beneath it flew a standard of a mountain crag and fir, argent on green. Whose house, I wondered desperately, searching the archives of my mind. From the corner of my eye I saw Jocelyn begin the sweeping castling bow, reaching for his daggers. With a shout I threw myself at him, cutting his knees out from under him. We rolled on the snowy ground together, while the allies of Cumlach stared. Whatsoever house they belonged to, I didn't want word out that a lone woman and a castling brother were travelling through the wilds of Cumlach. One of their number stepped forward, a seasoned warrior in well-worn arms.
"Identify yourselves," he snapped curtly.
It wasn't until then that I realized how we must look, the both of us, wind and snow-burned, swathed in scaldy furs, venturing alone through the worst of Cumlach's winter, with only a heavily laden scaldy pony to accompany us. "My lord!" I gasped, signing Jocelyn urgently to silence. "I am sorry. We mean no harm. Do we trespass here?" He settled back in the saddle, eased by my tone, my voice and accent clearly d'Angeline.
"No, lass. You've the right to passage, but it's not safe this close to the border. Who are you, and where are you bound?"
"Not to be easily swayed, then." I swallowed hard and lied through my teeth. "Surya of Trefail, my lord. This is my cousin Jareth." I trembled, not dissembling. To be undone now was unthinkable. "Our village was destroyed by scaldy raiders some days past. My cousin, took a blow to the head. I hid him in the empty granary. They never found us, my lord. We took these things from those who'll need them no longer, and fled for the city. Was that wrong?"
It was a gamble. I couldn't be sure of where we were, nor how well these scouts knew all the mountain villages. One thing was sure, though. Trefail had been destroyed by the Scaldi. I knew, because it was the village where Alcuin had been born.
"No, no, not wrong."
The scout's face was unreadable in the shifting firelight, embers scattered across the snow by Jocelyn's attempt to extinguish it.
"You thought we were Scaldi?"
"You might have been." I shuddered and stole a glance at Jocelyn. He was silent under the shadow of the wolf mask on his brow. "We didn't know, my lord. My cousin got scared." Jocelyn nodded without speaking, somehow managing to make it seem a dumb show, for which I was grateful. The leader chewed at his lower lip, ruminating. I saw his gaze wander over us, assessing our garb, our gear. I kept my head slightly averted, trusting to the flame-cast darkness to hide the telltale mark of Kushiel's dart. For a moment I thought we'd get away with it, but the scions of Carmiel are too martial to trust wholly to the element of chance in a chance encounter.
"There's nothing for you in the city of Elowa," he said cannily. "Winter's been hard, and it's fever-stricken. You'll ride with us to Bois Lagarde. The Marquis Lagarde won't turn away Carmeline refugees. You'll be well taken care of."
He turned to one of his men.
"Briss, ride on, and tell the Castellan we're coming in. Be sure to give him the details."
He stressed the last words. There was no mistake. The Lagarde rider began to turn his horse's head northward. Jocelyn moved like lightning, and what's more, he did it more like a scaldy than a castellan, with brutal efficiency. One dagger only, flashed from his sheath as he grabbed the leader of Bois Lagarde's scouting party, setting the blade to the man's throat.
"Everyone," he said tersely, "dismount, now."
They obeyed, eyes glaring fury. He set his teeth and held the dagger steady. Their leader stood unmoving.
I didn't need orders.
Working frantically, I stowed our gear, lashing the packs onto our scaldy pony.
"Two horses."
Jocelyn held himself rigid. I could see the effort it cost him to hold a dagger on a fellow d'Angeline. He was breathing hard.
"Scatter the rest."
I did it, though over a dozen armed warriors stood frozen in hatred, unwilling to sacrifice their leader by interfering with me. The horses scattered reluctantly, trained to obey.
I had to shout and wave my arms, slapping at their hindquarters with ferocity. They ran, then, in all directions, save the two whose reins I'd lashed to a tree. They tugged at their restraints, large eyes rolling to show the whites.
"For Surya, mount up!"
Jocelyn cursed at his near slip, jerking the dagger. The leader inhaled sharply.
"You won't get away," he said bitterly. "We'll come after you."
"Our kin in Marsilicos will protect us," I said defiantly. "You've no right to detain free Dangelines."
"Quiet,"
Jocelyn hissed at me.
"Surya, get out of here."
He'd followed my lead. I followed his, freeing one of the Carmeline horses, swinging into the saddle and plunging headlong through the woods, trailing the pony on a lead rope. To any who've not tried it, I do not recommend a blind flight through the wilds on horseback. We blundered, crashing through the undergrowth, both animals caught by the contagion of my fear. Jocelyn caught up with us, no more than half a mile out, a dark, blurred figure on horseback, and we rode for our lives. It was a clear night, blessed Eloah be thanked, the stars standing distant and frosty overhead. If not for that, we would surely have been lost. But the great plough and the navigator's star stood clear in the black skies above us, guiding our way and shedding their faint silvery light over the snowy landscape. Fixing a map in my mind, I headed us grimly south, hoping to intersect one of the great roads of the realm, Aishith's Way, that the Tiberians call the Via Paulus. Aishith's Way leads south to the coast. Marsilicos is her greatest city, founded long ago by Hellenes, even before Eloah's time, and because it is a harbour city, a great many wanderers end there. I hoped the Marquis Lagarde's men would take our bait and follow our trail south. We reached Aishith's Way come dawn, our Carmeline mounts staggering with exhaustion, foam-flecked and winded. The pony trotted behind us, sides heaving, still game. Half-dead with tiredness as I was, it put me to shame. There is little trade at this time of year. Now, in the bitterest winter, the road stretched open and empty before us, gilded with the pale gold light of dawn. The allies of Cumlach could not be more than a mile behind us. "A side road," I said to Jocelyn, lifting my voice with an effort. "Any road leading west, and pray they keep on toward Marsilicos." He nodded wearily. We pressed the horses, demanding speed they didn't have to give. An hour along Aisha's Way we saw it, a nameless road, only the signpost with Eloah's sigil indicating that it led to the city.
"There," Jocelyn pointed.
I cocked my head and listened. In the distance I could hear hoofbeats, an erratic multiple beat. A dozen men riding horses nigh as tired as our own.
"Ride!"
I gasped, setting heels to my mount. Once more, we fled. A mile along the route, we came upon the Yeshuite wagon. We nearly ran them down, in truth, coming hard around a bend. It was a narrow road, the horses done in, balked and wheeled. The team of mules set their ears and showed their teeth. Jocelyn shouted something, I don't know what, and a young girl poked her head out of the rear of the wagon, even as the driver turned round to look at us. I'd not known until that moment that it was a Yeshuite family, but I knew him by his sidelocks, long and dangling, while the rest of his hair was cropped at the neck. I would have said something then, but Jocelyn spoke first.
"Baruch Hata Adonai, father," he said at once, breathless and respectful, giving his castellan bow from the saddle before I could protest. "Forgive our intrusion."
"Baruch Hata Yeshua Ah Mashiach, Lo Harlam."
The Yeshuite driver said the words automatically, keen dark eyes gauging us.
"You are a follower of the apostate, I think."
He spoke to Jocelyn, who bowed again. A second face peered through the curtains at the back of the wagon, with a markedly girlish giggle.
"Yes, I am Jocelyn Verai of the Castelline Brotherhood."
"Indeed. And who is chasing you so hard?"
I drew breath to answer, but Jocelyn cut me off.
"Men who are apostate, even from the teachings of Blessed Eloah, father, fruit of Yeshua ben Yosef's vine. Stand aside, and we will go.
Ya'er Adonai Panav.
And why do they chase you?
To kill us, most like, by the time they catch us, I broke in impatiently. My lord...
Your horses, I think, will not go much further.
It was true, and I knew it, but they would go a little further, and right then my only thought was to put as much distance as possible between us and our pursuers, whose mounts must surely be as tired. For after them would come fresher riders, and if we could get beyond the borders of Cumlach ahead of them, we would be safer.
Yes, my lord, but...
Shelter us. Jocelyn's voice was abrupt, his eyes intense with the plea. The men who follow us, father, they'll not think to look in the heart of a Yeshuite family. They think we are rebels, perhaps Scaldi spies. I swear to you, we are not. We are free Dangelines, escaped from captivity, and we bear information on which the freedom of our nation hinges.
I drew my breath, terrified by the trust with which he revealed our secret. The Yeshuite nodded slowly, then glanced at the back of the wagon.
"How do you say it, Donnell?"
The curtains clashed open, and a woman with kind eyes and a shrewd face emerged, shooing the two girls into the depths of the wagon. She sized up Jocelyn and me, and her face softened, especially for Jocelyn.
"He is one of the apostate's own, Tavi. Let him in."
Raising her voice, she called into the wagon,
"Girls, make a room."
And so we came to join the Yeshuites. Chapter 55. I had not known before this of the relationship that existed between the Castellan Brotherhood and the Yeshuites. It is obvious, and I should have seen it, but it is not a thing which is discussed outside the society of Castellans. For although Carsiel was apostate, as the Yeshuites name him, he never broke faith with the one God, but only turned his face away in sorrow. Alone among the companions, he kept the commandments of his Lord, and did not commingle with mortals. Of course the Castellans believe he took on the duty that the one God neglected, love of the Son of Yeshua's blood, and the Yeshuites do not see it that way, but still it is enough for a common bond. For as I well knew, even the Castellans believe Carsiel chose damnation when he became Elowa's companion, the perfect companion. We turned the horses of Bois-Lagarde loose, driving them southward. Unexpectedly, Darnell and Tarvi's girls grew instantly enamoured of our Scaldi pony, and begged their father not to lose him. With a thoughtful mien he acceded, and our faithful pony was tied behind the wagon.
"A little truth seasons a lie like salt," he said pragmatically. "You have turned the horses free. We will say we found the pony wandering, if they ask. If they find us."
They did. It happened a scant hour after we'd come upon them, and not long after we'd been ushered into the back of the wagon, our gear stowed and hidden. Darnell supervised our concealment with level-headed efficiency, marshalling her giggling daughters to move skeins of wool and fabric to hide us. Tavi, it transpired, was a weaver, and she had some skill as a dyer. They made space for us in the tidy, well-ordered wagon, the girls giggling and nudging each other. Jocelyn, charmed, smiled at them. They giggled all the harder. My ears sharpened by Delaunay's training, I was the one who heard the hoofbeats. For all that had befallen us, I'd never felt so helpless, crouching in the dark behind bolts of fabric, while Tavi answered the riders' questions, two of them, by the sound of it, with disarming frankness. No, they were not bound for the city, but for La Reine, where they had kin. Yes, they had found the pony on Aishith's way, wandering alone and packless. No, they'd not seen anyone else. Yes, the Carmelines were welcome to look in the wagon. The curtains were yanked aside, and three Yeshuite faces gazed at the Bois-Lagarde riders, silent and apprehensive. From my hiding place, I caught a glimpse of one of the scouts' faces, weary and uninterested. The curtains clashed closed. We were free to go onward. The girls gave muted squeals of excitement as the mules trotted stolidly forward. Darnell shushed them, her arms around them both. I sighed quietly and felt Jocelyn do the same beside me.
We were 3 days with the Yeshuites. There are those who do not hold that there is any innate goodness to mankind. To them, I say, had you lived my life, you would not believe it. I have known the depths to which mortals are capable of descending, and I have seen the heights. I have seen how kindness and compassion may grow in the unlikeliest of places, as the mountain flower forces its way through the stern rock. I had kindness from Tavi's family. They asked us no questions, only shared with us wholeheartedly what they had to give. I learned a little bit of their story. I wish I knew more. They came from one of the inner villages of Kamlach, where their families had settled a generation ago, filling a need for village weavers and dyers. But fever came to the village, and the Yeshuites were blamed, for all but a courier had clearly brought it from the city of Eloah. So it was that they fled southward, the whole of their livelihood packed in that wagon. It was a strange thing to me, to see a family entire. I'd never thought before then, save at Perrenwald, how such a thing formed no part of my life. I remembered my parents vaguely, the road and the caravanserai, and after that the Dalwain of Sirius House. For Jocelyn it was different. Until the age of 10, he'd been a part of a family, a loving household. He'd had brothers and sisters. He knew how to play with children, to tease and tickle them. And they adored him for it. Tavi and Darnell smiled, well content that they'd chosen a right in aiding us. Me they regarded with a gentle pity, and spoke to with soft words. Such kindness, such misunderstanding. I grieved at what I was. Some miles shy of the city of Eloah, we parted ways. We had discussed it, the four adults, over the past night's fires. They had no wish to enter the city, where it was rumored that fever still raged. We had no choice.
"We would take you to the gates," Tavi said, worried. "It is not so far out of our way, I think, and you will be safe with us. Is it not so? No one will trouble with the poor weaver and his family."
"You've done enough, father," I said fondly. I understood by then that the title was of respect to an elder, for all but Tavi and Darnell had but a handful of years on us. "We don't know what welcome awaits us. Go to Laren and prosper. You've done more than enough." The girls, Maya and Rena, their names were, 6 and 8 years of age, played in the background. Maya had Jocelyn's white wolf pelt on her head and chased her younger sister, shrieking with laughter, while Rena ducked behind the placid pony and giggled. Darnell watched them complacently. Such sounds of fearless innocence rising up to the dusky sky. If Voldemar Selig had his way, the laughter of children, Dangeline or Yeshuite, would no longer ring freely under these same emerging stars.
"Still, I would..."
"No,"
Jocelyn said it gently, smiling, but with a firmness that said he would not be swayed. "We will ride with you to the crossroads, father, and the last miles we will walk. Not for love of Carsiel himself would I put your family in any further danger." Tavi opened his mouth for a final protest, and Darnell laid her hand on his arm.
"Let be," she reprimanded him kindly. "It is their will, and for the best."
He nodded then, reluctantly. On an impulse, I withdrew Melisande's diamond from around my neck and held it out to him. The diamond glittered in the firelight. "Here," I said, "for all you have done. It will go a long way to enabling you to establish yourselves in Laren." They looked at each other, then shook their heads, while the diamond hung glittering from my hand.
"It is too much," Tavi said, "and we did not help you for gain."
Darnell, her finger still laced around his arm, nodded agreement. "But," I protested.
"No," Tavi was firm. "Thank you, Fedra, but no. It is too much."
"You're stuck with that thing," Jocelyn said wryly, looking past me to where Maya and Rena hugged our scaldy pony, their chase forgotten. "But mayhap there is some small thing we may give you, father," he added, grinning. So it was that we took our leave of them, with tears and blessings on both sides. Perched high in the driver's seat, Tavi clucked to the mules, and they set off southward at a steady pace. Darnell and the girls waved from the rear of the wagon, and the shaggy pony trailed behind on his lead, trotting gamely. He had been the most loyal and steadfast of companions, and though it grieved me to part with him, I was happy that he would be rewarded by such tender fondness. Ahead of us, to the west, lay the white-walled city of Elawa, my home. Jocelyn blew out his breath, frosty in the chill morning air, and shouldered our packs. We'd not much to carry, having left the bulk of it with Tarvi's family. I kept my wolfskin cloak with Trigvi's dagger, while Jocelyn had the pelt of the White Brethren stowed in a bag along with some foodstuffs Darnell had provided and a pair of water skins. These things were all we had by way of proof of our sojourn. The ease that we'd found among the Yeshuites slipped away as we walked toward the city. It was months we'd been away. Who ruled from Elawa's throne? How deep laid was the conspiracy that had felled Delaunay? Who was part of it, and who was not? I realized with mounting anxiety the pitfalls that awaited us. What had Alcuin said? Trust Rouse, Trevelyan, Telesis de Mornay, the Dauphine, and not the king. The odds of Quintilius Rouse being in the city were slim. He would be wintering with his fleet. Trevelyan, perhaps, but he would be quartered at the palace, as likely would Telesis de Mornay, the king's poet, and, of course, Isandre de la Courcelle. And I remembered all too well what had happened when we tried to reach her at the palace. Blessed Elawa, I prayed fervently, let Melisande Shahrazai be elsewhere. Yet even if she were, I'd no idea who her allies were, the extent of her network. There was no way to approach the people Alcuin had named without running the gauntlet of the palace, and no one else I dared trust. Except Hyacinth. I shared my thoughts aloud with Jocelyn. He heard me out and gave no answer. You don't like it. He walked steadily, eyes on the horizon. There was some bit of traffic on the road now, not much as it was winter, but the occasional carriage passed, the occupants glancing curiously at us. Road-worn and dishevelled, our attire a mix of rude woollens and fur pelts lashed with thongs or pinned with bronze, Jocelyn's castellan hilt protruding over his shoulder. No wonder they stared. It made me increasingly uneasy.
There is no one else, Jocelyn said finally, that you can turn to. No patron, no friend of Delaunay's.
Not without risk. A gust of wind blew, and I tugged my cloak reflexively about me. We aren't talking about a simple favour, Jocelyn. Whomever we approach will hold our lives in their hands. I trust Hyacinth with mine, no one else.
The Prince of Travellers, he pronounced it with irony. How much gold could he get for it, do you think? Without thinking, I struck him across the face with my open palm. We stopped on the road and stood staring at each other. Tsingano or no, I said softly, Hyacinth has been a friend to me, when no one else was, and never asked a centime for it. When Baudouin de Trevelyan was executed, it was Hyacinth who gave me money to make an offering in his memory at the temples. Did you know that I was Melisande's farewell gift to Prince Baudouin before she betrayed him?
No.
Jocelyn's face was pale beneath the windburn, save for a ruddy patch where I'd slapped him.
I'm sorry.
If you have a better idea, I said grimly, then say it. But I'll not hear you speak against Hyacinth. He glanced toward the city. It was not far now. We could see the distant glint of its walls.
I can approach the captain of the king's castellan guard. He is a brother. He would have to give me audience. He is oath-sworn and may be trusted.
Are you sure? I waited until he looked back at me. Are you sure beyond doubt, Jocelyn? You disappeared from the city with your charge, a notorious servant of Narmar and plaything of the wealthy, leaving behind the slaughtered household of Anarfiel Delaunay. Do you know what poison's been spread in our absence? Are you sure of your welcome by the castellan brotherhood?
My words struck him like blows. It had never occurred to him, I could see,
that his honour as a Castellan could be impugned.
"No one would dare suggest such a thing," he gasped, "and even if they did, no Castellan would believe it."
"No," I asked wearily, "but I thought of it, and if I could, others would. As for believing, what is easier to credit? A simple murder, driven by greed and lust, or a vast, deep-laid conspiracy to betray the throne into Scaldy hands, known only to you and me?" After a moment he gave a curt nod, adjusted his back, and set his face toward the city.
"Your way, then, and pray your trust isn't misplaced. Anyway, we still have to make it through the gates."
I looked at the distant walls and shivered. For all of our fears, gaining admittance to the city proved the easiest of our trials. Two tired-looking members of the city guard halted us at a distance, glanced up and down at our bizarre attire, and demanded our names without much interest. I gave false names and a history, citing Tarvi and Darnell's village. They asked a few cursory questions, mostly about our health, then bid us to stick out our tongues for examination. Bemused, we obeyed without protest, and one of the guards drew near enough to look, then waved us through.
"It's true, then," Jocelyn said in a low voice. "There's sickness in the city."
I said nothing, overwhelmed at being once again within the city walls. It didn't mean as much to him. It wasn't his home. He'd not been born and raised here, as I had. The beauty of the place made me want to weep. The elegance of the cobbled streets, lined with gracious trees, now barren in winter. And the people, ah! Despite the cold and the rumoured fevers, there were people about, d'Angelines all, and the sound of their voices was music to my ears. As twilight fell, we made our way on foot to Knight's doorstep, winding through the poorer districts, where our appearance went largely unremarked. The scent of food cooking in homes and inns made my mouth water. D'Angeline cuisine, real food. We reached Knight's doorstep in good time. The street lamps were fresh lit, and the first revellers taking to the streets, their numbers thinner than I remembered, but still glorious in their silks and velvets, brocade and jewels shimmering in the lamplight. "Jocelyn, we can't go inside," I murmured as we stood in a shadowed alley across from the Cockerel. "The place would be turned upside down, and word would reach the palace by midnight. Tongues wag faster than you can blink in Knight's doorstep."
"Do you have an idea?"
"I think so. Listen," I said, and told him. Hyacinth's stable was quiet, too early for business, the horses drowsing in their stalls with the smell of good hay all around. There were two attendants on duty, boys of 12 or 13, tossing dice. We took them by surprise. One of them squeaked, seeing Jocelyn with drawn sword, and then both cowered. I couldn't blame them for being terrified. Even without the pelt of the White Brethren, with his clothing and his tangled hair, he looked more like a changeling Scaldy warrior than a Castellan brother. "You work for Hyacinth?" I asked them. They nodded. "Good. You," I pointed to the one who hadn't squeaked, "I need you to do something, and your friend's life depends on it. Find Hyacinth and bid him to come here, privately. Tell him an old friend needs his help. If he asks who, tell him we used to eat tarts under the bridge at Tertius Crossing. Have you got that?" He nodded again rapidly. "Old friend," he said breathlessly, "tarts, Tertius Crossing. Yes. "Good. I wouldn't have accorded me a title either, not in this state. If you breathe a word of it, a word, mind you, or if anyone overhears, your friend will die. Do you understand?" "Yes." His head bobbed so fast his forelock flopped in his eyes. "Yes, I swear it." "Good," I repeated, adding ominously, "and if we don't kill you, you may be sure Hyacinth will, if you make a mistake in this. Now go." He was out the door like a bolt, and we heard the sound of his running feet in the street. Jocelyn sheathed his sword.
"You're safe if he keeps his word," he said to the other lad, who stared white-faced at us. "Just don't think of following him."
Hyacinth's stable attendant shook his head in fervid terror. We waited, strung tighter than harp strings. Ever since I'd awakened in the covered cart, it seemed, aching and soul-sick, I'd been listening for approaching steps. I knew these. I knew the sound of Hyacinth's casual stroll, boot heels scraping against the cobblestones. And then he entered the stable and closed the door, and any pretense of ease disappeared. He turned around, his expression strained with hope and disbelief.
"Fedra?"
I took two steps and threw myself into his arms. It fell to Jocelyn to guard the door, sword drawn once more, against both anyone seeking entrance and escape by Hyacinth's assistance. The boy we'd sent had slipped in behind him and stood staring with his fist pressed against his teeth. To my shame, I was worse than useless, weeks' worth of pent terror releasing itself in shaking sobs, my face pressed to Hyacinth's shoulder. He held me hard and made soothing noises, his voice trembling a little with astonishment. When I could, I regained my composure and stepped away from him, wiping the tears from my eyes. "All right?" Hyacinth raised his eyebrows at me, and I nodded, taking a deep, shuddering breath. He beckoned to the boys and fished in his purse. "Listen to me, you two. What you saw tonight never happened. Understand?" Both nodded, silent acquiescence. "Here." He gave them both a silver coin. "You did well. Take these and keep your mouths shut. Don't even talk to each other about it. If you do, I swear I'll call the Dromond upon you and curse you so you wish you'd never been born. Understand?" They did. He dismissed them, and they ran with fearful glances at Jocelyn. Hyacinth hadn't looked closely at him. He glanced over now as Jocelyn sheathed his sword and blinked hard. "Carceline?" Jocelyn smiled wryly, inclining his head. "Prince of Travellers." "Blessed Elowa, I thought you couldn't draw your blade." Hyacinth shook himself as if waking from a dream. "Come on," he said decisively. "I'll take you to the house. You were right. It's not safe for you to be seen." I closed my eyes. "Do they think?"
"Yes. You were tried and convicted in absentia," Hyacinth said, his voice unwontedly gentle, "for the murder of Onofiel de Launay and the members of his household."
Chapter 56. Hyacinth lived still in the same house on Rue Coupole, but alone. To my sorrow, I learned that the fever of which we'd heard rumours had claimed his mother's life. She'd taken pity on a Tsingani family whose youngest was ill, and caught it from them. There were no tenants now, and Hyacinth was grimly set against taking others until the sickness had run its course. It manifested first, we learned, with white spots on the back of the tongue. That was why the city guard had examined ours, and had little interest in anything else. It was strange to be in that house without the presence of Hyacinth's mother muttering over her cook stove. He used it to heat water for the bath, sending one of his runners to the Cockerel for hot food, with word only that he was entertaining in private that night. To be warm and clean and safe seemed a luxury beyond words. We sat around the kitchen table and ate squab trussed in rosemary, washing it down with a rather good red wine Hyacinth had procured, taking turns telling what had happened between famished bites, sketching in the events. To his credit, Hyacinth never interrupted once, listening gravely as Jocelyn and I unwound our tale. When he learned of Deglamore's betrayal and the Scaldy invasion plan, he looked sick.
"He wouldn't," he said. "He couldn't.
He thinks to pull it off." I gulped a mouthful of wine and set down my glass. "But he has no idea of the numbers Selig can muster. We have to talk to someone, Hyacinth, the Dauphine, or someone who can reach her."
"I'm thinking," he murmured, reaching for his own glass. "Your lives are forfeit if anyone knows you've set foot in the city."
"How? Why? Why would they think we did it?"
Jocelyn had had a bit of wine, too, and was impassioned with it.
"What possible gain would there have been?"
"I can tell you the popular theory."
Hyacinth swirled the wine in his glass, gazing into its depths. "Rumour has it that Barkier Lanvert paid a fabulous sum for you to betray de Launay, and you your oath, Carceline, and admit his Arcadian guard into the house, to settle the old score for Isabel and set you both up in Kebel y Macard. There's no proof of it, of course, and he's not been formally charged, but the stories about the assassination of Dominic Stregardza haven't helped his cause.
I would never, I began.
I know. Hyacinth raised his gaze, dark eyes meeting mine. I knew it for a lie, and told whoever would listen. There were a few others who spoke on your behalf, I heard. Gaspard Trevelyan and Cecily Laveau-Perrin both did, and the prefect of the Castlean Brotherhood sent a letter protesting his order's innocence. He inclined his head to Jocelyn. But Parliament wanted a conviction, and the courts obliged. It won't do to have people thinking Dangely nobles could be slain out of hand, and their killers go unpunished. Melisande, I asked. I had already guessed. Hyacinth shook his black curls. If she was behind it, she kept her hand well hidden. She would. She played that card at Baudouin's trial. She's too canny to play it twice. I fingered the diamond without thinking. It would look suspicious, I added dourly. Hyacinth began to clear away the remains of our dinner without comment, stacking the plates in a washtub for later. All I have is at your disposal, Fedra, he said presently, returning to sit at the table, propping his chin on his hands. Poets and players go everywhere, know everyone. I can get word through them to whomever you like. The problem is, not a one of them can be trusted to keep silence. I looked instinctively at Jocelyn, who frowned. You say the prefect sent a letter? He asked Hyacinth, who nodded. Jocelyn shook his head. I don't know, he said reluctantly. If he protested the order's innocence and not mine, if he wrote rather than came to speak in person. No, I wouldn't trust him not to call the royal guard on us. I'll go to him myself, rather. Can you provide a mount? The last was addressed to Hyacinth. Yes, of course. No, I pressed my fingers to my temples. It's unsure and would take days. There's got to be another way. A thought struck me, and I raised my head. Hyacinth, can you find someone to deliver a letter to Telesis de Mornay? Absolutely, he grinned. A love letter, perhaps? A message from an admirer? Nothing easier. The only thing I can't guarantee is that it will arrive with the seal intact. It doesn't matter. My mind was racing. Do you have paper? I'll couch the real information in Cruinia. If any one of your poets can read Pictish, I'll eat this table whole. After rummaging in a chest, Hyacinth brought me pen and paper, shaving the quill with a sharp knife and setting the ink pot at hand. I penned a quick, fervid note of admiration in Dangeline, then added a few lines of Cruinia, structuring them to look like verse to the uneducated eye. The last student of he who might have been the king's poet awaits, at the home of the Prince of Travellers, begging your aid in the name of the king's signet, his only born. I read it aloud in Dangeline, then in Cruinia, stumbling over the pronunciation.
Cruinia, Jocelyn murmured. He thought himself beyond surprise. You speak Cruinia.
Not well, I admitted. I'd glossed over the fact that I knew neither the word for signet nor swan. I had translated Isandre de la Courcelle's emblem, in truth, as something closer to long-neck baby waterbird. But Telesis de Mornay spoke and read Cruinia, and moreover, it was she who told me that de Launay might have been the king's poet, had matters not fallen out as they had. Will it do?
It'll do, and more. Leave it unsigned.
Hyacinth, idling with his chair tipped back, moved into action, snatching the letter from my hand and grabbing a taper to seal it deftly with a blob of wax. Give it me now. There's a party bound for the lute and mask later this evening. I'll see it in Telesis de Mornay's hand by noon tomorrow, if I have to bribe half of Knight's doorstep to get it there. He was out the door within seconds, swirling his cloak around him.
You were right to trust him, Jocelyn said quietly. I was wrong.
I met his gaze across the table. He gave me his wry smile.
I can admit that much.
Well, and you were right about Tarvi and Darnell, I said to him. I never told you, but I could have killed you when you asked for their help. But you were right.
They were good people. I hope they're well. He stood up. If there's naught more to be done this night...
Go get some sleep.
I stifled a yawn at the thought of it. I'll stay awake until Hyacinth comes back.
I'll leave you alone, then. I'm sure you want a chance to talk with him.
The same wry smile, but something caught at it, twisting at my heart.
Jocelyn, I looked up at him. It seemed impossible to believe, here in this childhood haven, all that we'd been through together. All of it. Jocelyn, whatever happens to us, you did it. You kept your vow to protect and serve. You brought me home safe. I said softly, thank you.
He swept his castling bow and left me to wait. Hyacinth was some time returning and entered the house quietly, turning the key carefully in the lock. I started, having fallen into a doze, slumped at the kitchen table.
You're awake.
Hyacinth came to sit with me, taking my hands in his. You should be in bed.
How did it go?
Fine. He inspected my hands, turning them gently. Telesi should have the letter by tomorrow, unless young Mark Baptiste has a terrible quarrel with Japheth No Eglantine Varden, which is not likely. He thinks I'm sheltering Sarfiel the Reclusive, who is indeed mad enough to send the Prince of Travellers with an unsigned love note to the King's poet. Telesis was ill, you know, but the King's own physician attended her, and she's on the mend. Fedra, it looks like you've been working as a galley slave. I know. I pulled my hands away. They were red roughened and chafed by cold, scratched and torn, with dirt ingrained that a single bath couldn't remove. But I can build a fire with a single sodden log in the middle of a snowstorm.
Ah, Eloa.
Emotion flooded his face, his dark eyes liquid with unshed tears. I thought I'd lost you truly. Delaunay, Alcuin.
Fedra, I never thought to see you again. I can't believe you've survived what you did. To return here and find yourself branded a murderess. I'd have fought harder against it if I'd known you were alive. I'm so sorry.
I know, I swallowed hard. At least it's home, though, if I have to die anywhere. Oh, Hyacinth, I'm so sorry about your mother.
He was quiet a moment, gazing unthinking toward the cookstove that had seemed so eternally her domain, rife with muttered prophecy and the chink of gold coins. I know. I miss her. I always thought she would live to see me claim my birthright among the Tsingani, and not this sham I play at in night's doorstep. But I waited too long. He rubbed at his eyes. You should sleep. You must be exhausted.
Yes.
Good night, I whispered, kissing him on the brow. I felt his gaze follow me as I made my way to a warm and waiting bed. There is a point beyond exhaustion, where sleep is hard in coming. I had reached it that night. After so long sharing a bed, it seemed strange to be alone in one, in clean linen sheets, with a warm velvet coverlet atop them. Even after the strangeness of it wore off, giving way to drowsing familiarity, something seemed to be missing. The realization of what it was struck me with a shock, just before the tidal wave of sleep finally claimed me and dragged me under to the depths of oblivion, erasing the thought as the waves erase a line drawn in the sand by a child's stick. It was Jocelyn. I slept late into the morning and awoke remembering nothing of it. Hyacinth had been up and about and busy already, and the modest house gleamed. He'd brought in a girl he could trust, the daughter of a Tsingano seamstress his mother had known, to cook and clean. She went about her business with ducked head, eager to please, and fearing to meet the eye of the Prince of Travellers or his mysterious friends. "She'll say naught," Hyacinth assured us, and we believed him. He had found clothing, too, or bought it, rather, from the seamstress. I bathed again, murmuring a prayer of thanksgiving, as the hot water steeped further traces of the scaldy from my skin, and dressed afterward in the gown he'd provided, a dark blue velvet that did not fit too ill. Jocelyn, in a sober dove-grey doublet and hose, struggled to drag a comb through his hair, damp and clean, but matted with scaldy braidwork. He made no protest when I went to aid him with it,
easing out the tangles. His daggers, van braces, and sword lay in a tangle of steel and leathers on the kitchen table.
"You're not..."
I began to ask. He shook his head, hair sliding over his shoulders.
"I may have kept you alive, but I've broken my vows nonetheless. I don't have the right to bear arms."
"Do you want me to put it in a single braid, then?"
I gathered his hair in my hands, feeling the fair silken mass of it.
"No," he said resolutely. "I'll put it in a club. I've still the right to that much as a priest."
He was that, though I had forgotten it.
I watched as his hands moved deftly, binding his hair into a club at the nape of his neck. Even without his arms, he looked a Castellan again. Hyacinth observed it all without comment, only the arch of his brows reminding me how far it was from where we'd begun.
"We should burn those," he said aloud, wrinkling his nose at the pile of garments, furs, and woolens we'd shed.
"No, leave them," I said quickly. "Elawa, the smell alone will testify to our story, and we've naught else to prove it."
Jocelyn laughed.
Shaking his head in bewilderment, Hyacinth glanced out the window onto the street and tensed.
"There's a carriage drawing up to the doorstep," he said, his voice tight. "You'd best get in the back. There's an exit out the postern gate. If it's not De Mornay, I'll hold them off as long as I can."
We moved quickly, Jocelyn sweeping his gear off the table, and hid ourselves in the scullery, where there was a passage to the rear of the house. It didn't take long. I heard the door open and one person enter, Hyacinth's courteous greeting. The voice that answered was unmistakable, fainter than I remembered, but rich and feminine. Telesis De Mornay. I remember that I stumbled out of hiding, weeping, even as she drew back the hood of her cloak, revealing the familiar plain features illumined by her dark eyes, which held grief and welcome alike. She took me in her arms, her embrace quick and fierce, unexpectedly strong.
"Ah, child," her voice whispered at my ear, "I'm so glad to see you alive. Anafiel de Launay would be proud of you."
She grasped my arms then, shaking me a little.
"He would be so proud," she repeated.
I gulped back my tears, gathering myself, fighting the shudder in my voice.
"Telesis, we need to speak to the Dauphine, to Gaspard Trevelyan, Admiral Rouse, to whomever you trust. The Scaldi are planning to invade. They've a leader, and the Duke d'Aiglemont plans betrayal."
"Shh."
Her hands at my arms steadied me. "I got your message, Phaedra. I knew you were no traitor. I'm taking you now to an audience with Isandra de la Courcelle. Are you ready to bear that much?" It seemed sudden, too sudden. I looked around for an instant, frantic and uncertain. Jocelyn stepped up to my side, empty-handed, but armed in Castellan rigor.
"She will not go alone," he said in his softest, most deadly tone. "In the name of Carsiel, I will bear witness to this."
"And I," Hyacinth bowed gracefully in his best Prince of Travellers manner, but his eyes when he straightened were cold and black.
"I have lost Phaedra no de Launay once already, my lady, and protested too little. I do not propose to let the same mistake happen twice, and mayhap it will be that my small gift of the Dromond may be of service in this matter."
"It may be, Tsingano." Telesis de Mornay gazed at him with her intent dark eyes, laying one small hand upon his sleeve. "I pray that it may." Chapter 57. It was at once like and unlike the old days, a covered carriage bearing me to the palace to meet in secret with one of Elawa's line. But no longer was I the darling of Nama's patrons, garbed in exquisite finery, awaited in breathless anticipation. Now I was a condemned murderess and an escaped Scaldi slave, awaiting the judgment of the heir apparent of the realm, the very gown on my back there only by courtesy of the scapegrace of Knight's doorstep. Only the scarlet mote in my eye and the unfinished mark that twined my spine gave tongue to what I was, De Launay's Anguissette, the only such born in 3 generations. We told our story, Jocelyn and I, to Telesis de Mornay in her carriage. Not the whole of it, nor the details of our escape, but the gist of what mattered to the throne of Terre d'Ange. She listened intently, turning aside now and then to cough. She believed, of that I had no doubt. But would Isandra de la Courcelle? I had not met her and could not guess. The carriage drew round to a seldom-used entrance to the palace, where we were met by guards in House Courcelle livery, midnight blue, with the silver insignia. Delaunay's lessons were not lost on me. I looked closely, and observed somewhat. Each of them bore on the small finger of his left hand a silver ring. "The Dauphine's personal guard," Telesis said, stifling a cough. "She'd seen me looking. They may be trusted." The Courcelle guards checked us for weapons. Jocelyn handed them the bundle of his castellan arms with a curt bow, and Hyacinth gave them the dagger at his belt, sliding another out of his boot, and gave it over with a shrug. I bore no weapons, but I had Trigvi's dagger in a sack with the other scaldic items, and protested its removal, for those were our only proofs. "I will take custody of these things," Telesis said firmly, and the guards did not demur, nor did they search her. She was the king's poet, and the Dauphine's confidant, and above suspicion. Thus were we issued into the presence of Isandra de la Courcelle. I had seen her at a distance from hiding, and at the trial of House Trevelyan. Still I knew not what to expect. It was a formal audience room to which we were conducted, albeit a small one. I learned later that we were in the king's quarters, and not the Dauphine's. I learned why, too. But for now, my worst fear was allayed. No other d'Angeline nobles were present. We would be heard, at least, and not seized upon entry. Isandra de la Courcelle sat on a high-backed chair, flanked by a half-dozen guards in royal Courcelle livery, all bearing the silver ring. Her face was cool and impassive, with all the pale beauty of her Lanvers mother's line. Only her long slender neck bore the stamp of House Courcelle, who took the swan as their emblem. "Your Highness," Telesis made a deep curtsy, "from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for granting this audience."
"We appreciate your service to our house, King's Poet. Who do you bring before us?"
Isandra's voice was, as I remembered it, light and controlled. She knew. The question was a formality.
"Fedrano Delaunay, Jocelyn Verailles of the Castellan Brotherhood, and—" Telesis de Mornay hesitated at Hyacinth, not sure how to name him. He stepped forward and bowed.
"Hyacinth, son of Anastasia of Marnodge's Cumpania."
A Tsingani designation. I'd never heard him use it before. I'd never known his mother's name, but I'd no time to sorrow, for Isandra de la Courcelle's gaze was fixed on me, deep violet eyes burning like embers in her pale face. If we were guilty, mine was the gravest betrayal in her mind, that was clear.
"You," she said, "you to whom Anathiel Delaunay gave his name, stand convicted of killing him, who was oath-sworn to ward me with his life. How do you plead to that, Anguissette?"
It gripped me like a wave, a nameless emotion rising from the soles of my feet to lift the very hair on my head. I had lost nearly all that I loved, had been through torture and slavery and the brutal killing cold of scaldy winter to meet this accusation. I held her gaze and gave it back, a wash of red filming my vision, the words I'd been entrusted with so long ago coming to my tongue.
"In the name of the King's Signet, his only born, I bring you a message, Your Highness. When the Black Boar rules in Alba, Elder Brother will accede."
The words rang in the small room, oddly resonant. The Courcelle guard shifted, and a curious expression crossed Isandra's face.
"Yes," she said, "I know. Quintilius Rouse sent another messenger. Is that all you have to say?"
"No," I drew a deep breath. "But it is the message I was charged to bring, many weeks gone by. I am innocent of the death of Anathiel Delaunay and his household. May the earth rise and swallow me if I am not."
"Jocelyn Verailles of the Castellan Brotherhood is innocent."
he bowed silently in response. I kept my gaze on Isandra's.
You have been betrayed, Your Highness. The Duke Isidore d'Eglamour plots to bring down the throne and conspires with the Scaldi warlord Voldemar Selig. I have been 2 months and more a slave and a refugee among the Scaldi. They plan to invade, and they plan to betray d'Eglamour, and unless they are stopped, they will succeed.
Whether or not she believed, I do not know, but the blood drained from her face, leaving her like a marble statue in her high-backed chair. Only those eyes continued to blaze.
You charge Isidore d'Eglamour, hero of the realm, leader of the allies of Cumlach, with this terrible crime?
Not alone. I held my ground in the face of her awful stare.
I charge the Lady Melisande Charizai of Cushith, who is d'Eglamour's ally. It was her word that betrayed Delaunay, and it is her word conveyed in writing that assures Voldemar Selig of the Scaldi that his plan will succeed.
Isandra turned away, whispering something to one of her guards. He nodded and then departed. She turned back to me expressionless.
Tell me what you claim to have witnessed.
We told the whole story then, Jocelyn and I both, beginning with the longest night, telling of the slaughter at Delaunay's house, Melisande's betrayal, and our sojourn among the Scaldi. The Dauphine of Terre d'Ange listened and stared into the distance, her chin propped on one fist. Telesis de Mornay spilled the contents of our pack on the marbled floor at the appropriate time, displaying our worn Scaldi pelts and Trigvi's dagger. Hyacinth stepped forward and testified to our condition, finding us in his stable.
"And that is all you have to offer?"
Isandra de la Courcelle mused, contemplating the items on the floor. "A wild tale and a heap of stinking hides as proof?"
"Summon Melisande Charizai, then," Jocelyn said, his blue eyes flashing, "and let her be questioned. I swear by my oath that all we have told you is true."
The guard, sent on an errand, returned unobtrusively, slipping through the door and closing it carefully behind him. Isandra arched her fair brows at him, and he shook his head.
"The Lady Charizai," Isandra murmured, "is not in residence, it seems. But if what you say is true, why would she let you live?"
The cool gaze turned back to me.
"No member of House Charizai is a fool, and that one least of all, I think."
I opened my mouth to answer, and found myself unable to frame a reply. How did one say such a thing to the king's daughter? The blood rose to my face, a hot blush overtaking me. Her gaze never wavered as I began to stammer out a response. Hyacinth and Telesis spoke simultaneously. To my mortification, I heard his words clearly.
"The answer, Your Highness, is worth 1,000 ducats, and would take some time to give."
While the king's poet quoted an Isandine fishing proverb,
"If you catch the speaking salmon in your shrimp net, cast him back."
"Ah." One syllable and the merest arch to the brows.
"Your Highness,"
Jocelyn bowed, having regained his composure, his voice coming calm and level into her pointed silence.
"Even were that not so, for a scion of Cushiel to kill one marked by Cushiel's hand would bring a curse upon the house," he said reasonably.
"Nor is it counted lucky to murder a priest.
Melisande Charizai did not kill us, but she deemed our survival a slender chance at best. That we would escape and returned uncaptured, she never dreamed."
"No one in their right mind would have dreamt it," he added soberly. "That we stand before you is a measure of blessed Eloa's grace."
"So you say. You have naught else?"
Telesis de Mornay stepped forward. "They have my word, Your Highness. I knew Anarfiel de Launay. I knew him well. He trusted his pupils with his life."
"Did he trust them with his secrets?"
The arched brows turned toward the king's poet.
"Did he tell Fedra no de Launay that he was my oath-sworn protector?"
Telesis made a slight, helpless gesture, glancing at me. She knew, I think, that he had not. The feeling returned, the wave lifting me out of myself.
"No, my lady," I whispered, "he did not."
But that you would have been better served if he had." I had given no thought to what I uttered, and it terrified me to hear my own words, for there was bitterness in them. Anarthiel de Launay taught me and used me, and kept me in ignorance, thinking to protect me. And if he had not, mayhap he would not have died, for I might have guessed Melisande Charizai's game, if I'd known what was at stake. I was the only one close enough to see it, but I did not, and he is dead." Jocelyn stirred next to me, willing me to silence. We understood these things who had been slaves together. Too late, and I was too far gone in my anger. I stared at the Dauphine, and a connection formed in my mind, so simply that I almost laughed with relief. "The guard, Your Highness! Question the guard!" Jocelyn moved again, this time with a jolt.
"Your Highness, we sought an audience with you, then with the king's poet, the night of de Launay's murder. Both times we were turned away."
He grinned, the flash of white teeth unexpected. "A Castlean brother and an Anguissette in a sanguin cloak. Surely one of them would remember." For a moment I thought she would refute the idea. Then Isandra de la Courcelle nodded to the guard she'd sent before.
"Go," she said. "Be discreet."
She looked back at us, and I saw for an instant a frightened young woman gazing from behind the mask of authority.
"Ah, Eloa," she said, grief in her voice. "You're telling the truth, aren't you?"
I understood then the nature of her anger and her fear, and sank to my knees gazing up at her. We had brought to her the last news any ruler wished to hear.